Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I am Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, Fred, what happened next?
Well, I happen to have a magazine in my hand called Creation Magazine.
I think it'll
help us to know what happened next.
What happened next? That's right. This is the summer edition of Creation Magazine. You could find it online at creation.com. You could subscribe. It's a tremendous magazine.
Very good magazine.
Yeah. And Fred, we started going through this last week. So now let's just dig right into a typical article. How about this one here? You know the one on page 10 about the motors in these simple cells? Turns out that many simple single-celled creatures have amazing electrical outboard motors, like the flagellum. We've talked about a flagellum, right?
Yeah.
Just a motor that spins so that the single-celled organism could get around.
Yeah, it rotates at an incredible, like, 100,000 revolutions per minute.
Yeah,
it's got a rotor and a stator, all these things that are, you know, it's a machine.
So sophisticated. And it'll stop and go into rewind in like a split second. But it turns out that there are many single-celled creatures that have all kinds of motors. And lo and behold, this is according to evolutionary sources like Science Daily and the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, all recent articles this year. It turns out that these motors operate in some kind of a coordinated fashion.
Yeah, the researchers at University of Virginia reported that when this simple organism or algae, when it swims, the molecular motors operate in an amazingly coordinated manner.
Whoa. So you got algae. We think of algae as it's just scum, right? So you've got this scum or this algae that fish eats, part of the cycle of life, the great ecosystem God designed. And isn't just that funny, Fred? Evolutionists, they talk about a species, an endangered species, and if one species dies, how it hurts all other species, and maybe the whole ecosystem will break. Well, imagine if they're right, and there's only one species in the whole world, how is it going to survive with no ecosystem to provide all its needs?
Oh, yeah, the whole system is so complex, it's remarkable.
And you've got all these services and redundant services provided by a million species, and how is one or three species going to survive? It's just absurd. But anyway, so Fred, here, simple algae, it's not simple at all. It's so sophisticated, and they have these motors. They're coordinated. They work together.
Yeah, they all pull in one direction as if under command or in the opposite direction. Again, as if it's under some sort of strict command.
Wow.
And, you know, evolutionists, they love to use words like simple and prehistoric. I mean, words can be powerful, and it gives the illusion of evolution. And yet, these things aren't simple.
So you not only have motors, that each motor in and of itself is so wildly complicated. And just take a few parts away and see if it works, right? They break. But then you need them to be coordinated so they're all pulling in the same direction. That's just one example of a level of complexity that Darwin and even Dawkins were not thinking about just a year ago. This is wildly complex stuff.
Yeah, Darwin had no idea at his time. You know, he thought the cell was like a black box.
Right.
Basically, just a simple blob. Well, these things are remarkably complex. And I remember Darwin even made a prediction that if any organ did not form by slight changes over time, accumulating over time, that his theory is not true.
Yeah, so Darwin himself points out that if there's some function in an animal or a plant that could not form by little incremental changes, then natural selection could not work. That's so obvious. And didn't Haldane make that point also?
Yeah, he's a famous scientist from the 1950s, mathematician, atheist, of course. He made a prediction that things like wheels and magnets could not form naturalistically.
Right, because what was his point? Why couldn't a magnet or a wheel form by Darwinism? He said because it wouldn't add any advantage until it functioned.
Yeah, until it was completely there.
Until it was there and functioning, it wouldn't help the creature survives, so therefore he made the same point Darwin made.
Exactly.
Anything that could not add to your survival chances by incremental steps would not form by evolution. Well, these simple motors, for example, these motors are irreducibly complex. But now we have levels of control, like operating systems on top of drivers, you know, levels of sophistication that the microbiologists weren't even thinking of 5 years ago, that now they realize there's so many levels of sophistication. But are there wheels? Are there magnets, Fred, in organisms and living creatures?
Oh, absolutely. We talked about before the rotors and stators in the flagellum. And just the fact that these are little tiny motors and they're all working in coordination with each other. So how did that happen?
Yeah, by chance.
So natural selection, one of them happens to do pretty well and another one says, hey, I'm going to do that too.
Right.
And there's a lot of these things. And, you know, you can fit these things on the pin of a needle, I think probably 18 million of them. And I know that's the number of the bacteria.
On the head of a needle.
On the head of a pin or needle.
Millions and millions of these things. And say birds that will fly 6,000 miles or more, and they're sensing the magnetic field of the Earth. And so there are many creatures. In fact, there's evidence that this ability goes far beyond birds in all kinds of creatures. We've covered this in Real Science Friday, have an ability to sense the magnetic field of the Earth. So Haldane, who's a mathematician, says evolution can never produce magnets, could never produce wheels, because those things would confer no advantage until they were functioning.
Exactly, until they're fully in place, operating.
There's a thousand examples of that. Like, remember the trochlea challenge on our website, kgov.com? We covered that. The human eye has a trochlea, a sling, as so that the muscles could fit and the eye could be turned and all. And that sling, that would offer no advantage until it was functioning. It's the simplest thing, but it could never form by chance. Just look up trochlea. Just Google trochlea challenge if you're an evolutionist.
There you go, trochlea challenge, and it'll take you to your website, right?
Yeah.
And they can look at that picture. And the picture is powerful because there's like an eyelet hole.
Yeah.
That this little sling goes through.
This muscle.
And
yeah.
How does that happen by chance? How did it know to form there? And how did the little thing know to, that little tendon know to go through that eyelet hole and come around to hold the eye in place?
Right. And it wouldn't evolve unless it was adding some benefit. And it couldn't add any benefit until it had at least a minimal functionality. And so your DNA, which has nothing to do with that eye itself, the DNA is separate. It's an information system describing how to build the sling. The changes have to occur there, and they have to affect muscles and tissues, you know, all different kinds of tissues.
Well, Bob,
it's
funny. And you mentioned the migration. I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but I love the story of the golden plover. It migrates from Alaska to Hawaii, and it's like 2,000 miles. And what they've discovered is, based on the amount of energy, they use food for energy. They'll eat a bunch of food, they'll put on weight, and then they convert that weight to energy. Hmm. And they do it very efficiently, much more efficient than, say, a military helicopter. Hmm. But anyways, they would make it 500 miles short of Hawaii based on their flying ability and the amount of weight they put on.
They couldn't reach Hawaii.
They could not reach Hawaii.
Unless what?
But they do. We know that they do, and there's no islands in between. There's no,
right.
There's nowhere they can
rest.
Land and rest and,
right.
You know, and take a break and have lunch.
And eat more.
Yeah. But something allows them to make it to Hawaii.
What?
They fly in a V formation.
The V formation, it reduces the drag. The lead animal, the lead bird, is bearing the brunt of the friction, the drag. And so
the weaker birds are in the back.
And then they rotate.
Absolutely.
So the lead bird, after he does his stint, he falls back, and one of the second ones take the lead. And they take turns riding in each other's wake, so to speak. It's like a bicycle behind an 18-wheeler.
So when you see a V formation in the sky of these birds, you know what the purpose is. And it's a sign of there's an information that these birds have been given
that's
to
so
do this.
Awesome.
Now, they're not taught this by their parent birds. The golden plover, the adults take off and they leave the young behind. The young have to figure it out for themselves, or maybe the information is already there.
So Charles Darwin, J.B.S. Haldane, they pointed out, look, if you have something in a living organism that can't add benefit step by step, then it could not have evolved. And we now know that there are thousands of things like that.
Oh, absolutely.
Magnets and wheels and slings, thousands of things. All right. So, Fred, how about also in this Creation magazine, there's an interesting article. You know those bogus drawings that were made of the fetus, a human fetus in the womb, supposedly looking like a fish or a reptile?
And it's supposed to be to show the evolutionary stage in the womb.
Yeah.
And there is a German scientist that came up with this idea. His name was Ernst Haeckel. Hmm. And he coined the term ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
That is so sophisticated. That must be true because yeah,
it sounds so good. It must be true.
Multisyllabic words.
Well, as it turns out, he drew these drawings of different types of embryos, like chicken embryo,
and a fish embryo, a reptile, so that the baby human has scales,
yes.
The baby human has a tail.
And his drawings, when you look at them, they all look real similar.
They're very convincing because you see there's the baby. My son, Josiah, at one point was a fish.
Yeah.
I mean, as an embryo, he was a fish. He had scales. Then he was a reptile. He had a tail. There it is in Haeckel's drawings.
Well, as it turns out, these drawings were complete frauds. Embryologists have we've got pictures now, and you can, Google and, look up ontogeny.
See an actual embryo.
You can see the actual embryo side by side, and they don't look anything like Haeckel's drawings. And so it's fraudulent, yet this stuff pervades
our
textbooks.
So he did this on purpose. Of course, he could have taken embryos from miscarriages and draw them accurately.
He could have used real science, but he chose to use fairy tale.
And that's what he supposedly did, but he knows he committed a fraud. He didn't draw the embryos accurately. He drew them to look like fish and look like reptiles, and it was a fraud. Well, it's stuck, hasn't it? They're still using this fraud.
Oh, yeah. This stuff still pervades our textbooks. And I don't know, maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, I corresponded with a Harvard professor about this issue because he had them on his website. He had these fraudulent drawings, these Haeckel drawings on his website that his students would go and see for his class on biology. And he responded back and said, well, they're not really accurate, but they convey the picture.
And the picture is what? That the embryo recapitulates the evolutionary story of Homo sapiens? Even if evolution were true, we know that this idea is not true because the embryo doesn't look like a fish. It doesn't have scales. It doesn't have a tail. This is all make-believe.
Yeah, and I told him these pictures are a fraud, and he says, well, I'll put a caption underneath that this doesn't convey the image of an embryo. But yet he kept that up there because images can be powerful. It's
right. Brainwashing. So he put a disclaimer, but he said, but really this makes the point.
Exactly.
It makes the point that evolutionists are liars.
Yeah, his disclaimer was really pretty worthless.
Yeah, so we're a century later, and not only that Harvard professor, Fred, that you corresponded with, but many continue this lie that the embryo is really just some kind of animal, not human.
Yeah, and they use this to justify abortion. And they're trying to say, well, you're basically getting rid of a fish.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous because the embryos, again, are completely different between different kinds of
life.
Oh,
yeah. Right. And so it turns out that this Ernst Haeckel, he received an award. There's a New York Times headline. This is the kind of thing I love from Creation Magazine. It's so rich with information and history and science. In 1907, the New York Times had a headline, Kaiser Honors Haeckel. And here's how the story reads. Berlin, March 8th, 1907. The Kaiser, Emperor William, today bestowed on Professor Ernst Haeckel, the celebrated Darwinian and founder of the Association for the Propagation of Ethical Atheism, the title of Excellency.
So, ethical atheism?
Ethical. He is the founder of the Association for Ethical Atheism. Fred, you can't make this stuff up. So the founder, Ernst Haeckel, is the founder of the Association for Ethical Atheism. He's conferred this honor, and he is the one who did the fraud of the embryo drawings.
And, and this worldview was really pervasive in Germany at this time, and this is 1907. I think we know what happened with history after this.
That's exactly right. And as Ben Stein's movie does a great job showing, his movie, Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, shows the Darwinian influence on the Nazis, and it was intense. And that's why they wanted to kill human beings who they viewed as inferior. And it's the whole eugenics movement, which was also supported by Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger, founder.
Ideas have consequences.
Yeah, they sure do. So much for ethical atheism.
Yeah.
The guy who gets the award, who founded the Atheist Ethical Association, commits the fraud of these drawings. And you know what's interesting? This still, it has an ongoing influence. Not only is it in all these public school textbooks, but the scientist from up in Montana at the Rocky Mountain Museum.
Jack Horner.
He's the guy that they based the Jurassic Park movies on. He's a real-life curator who has found these soft-tissue T-Rex dinosaurs, which is astounding, really. And he has just supervised an experiment with a university in Canada, McGill University, where they said, well, you know, we know that the embryo recapitulates evolution. And so since birds have evolved from dinosaurs, therefore chickens, we could do an experiment and get the chick in the egg as it's evolving. We could do an experiment and make its tail evolve real long like a dinosaur tail.
So Jack Horner wanted to grow a dinosaur from a chicken embryo.
That's what he wanted to do, at least a dinosaur-like tail on a chick.
I wonder what happened.
It failed.
Shocker there.
Yeah, but he's doing this. The famous Jack Horner is doing this because he still thinks that Ernst Haeckel, that his drawings were real. His drawings were not real. It was a fraud.
It's all based on that. But, Bob, I remember you had a conversation with Jack Horner. Don't you have a...
I did have a conversation with Jack Horner. In fact, we have it on our CD, the Walt Brown Week that we offer through our store at kgov.com. Or if people call us at 1-800-8-NYART, they could get our Walt Brown Week CD where we had the great scientist Dr. Walt Brown on. In fact, you know what I'd like to do, Fred? Why don't we play this?
Oh, I think that'd be great.
The Walt Brown Week CD. And on here, we offered, since Jack Horner, almost like reality mimicking fiction, Jack Horner actually discovers a soft tissue T-Rex dinosaur. Now they're finding all kinds of soft tissue dinosaurs, like a duck-billed hadrosaur. They found two of those so far with soft tissue. They're sequencing the proteins.
Yeah, and I remember you wanted to do a test on those bones. These unfossilized bones they're finding a T-Rex, which show that there's no way they're millions of years old. They can't be.
Yeah, they're not.
They're within thousands, if not even hundreds of years old.
They're not 30 million, 50 million years old. They wouldn't stay unfossilized, and they wouldn't stay soft and supple.
He even admitted they smelled like the cadavers in his lab. They still had an odor to them of death.
So, Fred, we haven't heard this call in years, but I think we're ready to play it, are we? Let's hear. This is when I called Jack Horner at the Museum of the Rockies at Montana State University. Let's hear this.
Paleo.
Hello, could I speak to Jack Horner?
Yeah, who's calling?
This is Bob Enyart with KLTT Radio in Denver, Colorado. That's Bob Enyart.
Let me transfer you over to his office. I think he should be in there right now.
Hello?
Hello, Jack. This is Bob Enyart with KLTT Radio in Denver.
Uh-huh.
How are you doing?
Good.
Jack, I sent a letter to Bob Harmon a few weeks back offering the museum a grant of $8,000 to do a carbon-14 date test of that soft tissue T-Rex you guys dug up. And he said he would forward that to you. And I'm wondering if you saw that or considered it.
Well, Carbon 14 doesn't work on something that old.
I understand that, and normally we wouldn't expect to get soft tissue out of a T-Rex skeleton either, but sometimes science proceeds by crossing your T's and dotting your I's, and you guys might have other things you'd like to carbon 14 at the same time. In fact, in the last couple of weeks, I've been able to raise a little more money, so that's up to $10,000 now that we'd be honored to give you guys. if you would consider doing that test?
Well, we can't do that test.
You can't do that?
No.
Do you mean the museum doesn't have the laboratory?
We certainly don't.
Okay, well, we're happy to pay the expense of having a lab do the test in addition to the $10,000 to the museum.
Do you know how carbon-14 works?
Yeah, I'm familiar, and I realize it's useless for anything over maybe 50,000 years or so. But I've done a talk show in Denver for 15 years, and mm-hmm. there's a group of folks interested in science. Of course, that discovery caught their attention, and they thought, well, it'd be logical to do this, to just go ahead and do it, even though nobody would be inclined to do it, just like nobody would be inclined to look for soft tissue inside right. of a T-Rex.
Well, yeah, and, you know, we're still trying to figure out what it is, what it's right. actually made of.
Right, exactly, whether it's hemoglobin or whatever.
Well, yeah.
Jack, is the amount too small that it's just not worth the consideration?
No, that's not it.
Okay. What if I were able to raise more money?
No, that the amount of money has nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because carbon-14 doesn't work on something like this,
right?
Your results that you get could be all over the place.
Well, they should be infinity. It should be not datable. In other words, it shouldn't come back saying it's 25,000 years old.
Right.
It should be infinity. And so that will be a worthwhile...
Well, infinity isn't exactly what you get.
Okay.
I mean, it's like trying to date a piece of concrete.
Right. You wouldn't
have to have carbon in it.
Right. You wouldn't use carbon-14. Now, the skeleton is... not fossilized. Isn't that true, or largely not?
Well, it's you know, the bone is made of calcium phosphate.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, we're still trying to figure out what the actual soft tissue is.
Right. And, see, we were hoping that a test like this would just add another... bit of scientific information that you would have at your disposal. And also, in that grant letter, we asked if it could be a blind test with five different specimens, and therefore then the museum could test four other specimens that you might want to have carbon-14 dated, and so you could put it all in the same batch, and those testing then will pay the cost of that. That'll be free to the museum plus the $10,000 grant.
Let me tell you where I'm coming from here.
Sure.
All right. Obviously, your group is a group of creationists.
Yes.
And the spin they can get off of it.
Right.
Doing it is. Well, not going to help us.
Yeah. So even though it's just a scientific test, they're not asking for voodoo or anything.
It's not actually a scientific test. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Carbon-14 dating something with soft tissue in it. Jack, if I could raise $20,000, would it be worth?
I will talk to Mary Schweitzer about it.
Okay. I appreciate that. And how about this? I'll resend you the grant letter with the amount of $20,000 in it. And then you could talk to Mary, and we'll see where it goes.
I want to know what group is sponsoring it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's
I need some really specific details about...
Sure.
And don't... Just, you know, tell it to me straight. Okay?
Of course. I've hosted a daily talk show for 15 years. We're on a 50,000-watt AM station, KLTT. Mm-hmm. And there's a local church here, Denver Bible Church, mm-hmm. that's offered to help. But we also have pledges from any number of individuals in the Denver community.
Okay.
So we could, if you guys agree, we could send you the check within 24 hours.
Okay. Well, let me talk to Mary, and okay. let me just talk to a few people.
Okay.
Because I don't want to, you know, I can't afford to have it turn into a circus.
Right. Well, I do understand that, and I appreciate your time. So,
okay. I will see Mary this next week.
Oh, that's fabulous. I'd be happy to call you back in 2 weeks from now.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you so much, Jack.
You're very welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Boy, Bob, that was a great call.
That's some interesting call, huh? Fred, you saw the letter, I think, that we sent to Jack Horner.
Yeah, and you ended up getting, what, $23,000 in pledges?
$23,000 that we offered them, $20,000 to do the test and $3,000 to pay the lab. So a total of $23,000.
And what's great about this is he was pretty much caught, because if he admits to carbon-14 date it, then we're going to get carbon-14 in there, and they shouldn't be there because carbon-14 shouldn't be around after 50,000 years.
That's exactly
right. And if
right.
he doesn't want to do it, he's admitting that he has a problem, because he knows that this thing's going to have carbon-14 in it.
Yeah.
And it's going to go against their whole worldview that these dinosaurs are millions of years old.
And carbon-14 is showing up everywhere, no matter what they date. They date diamonds. They date amber. They date oil, gas, coal. Everything they look at has carbon-14 in it, things that should be carbon-14 dead.
Yeah, exactly. And so carbon-14 is a friend of creationists.
It really is. So here's Jack Horner in this article. Still, Jack, I wish you would have taken our offer. Fred, tonight there's a meeting, Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship.
Yes, at Bethlehem Lutheran Church at 7 o'clock, 2100 Wadsworth Boulevard. And I'm also going to be speaking at August 29th at Holy Hills Church, 9770 South Foothills Canyon Boulevard. And you can find out this information at youngearth.org.
Youngearth.org. Yes. So tonight, and come on out also to hear Fred Williams. Get that info at youngearth.org. And if you are a new listener to Bob Benyart Live, or you've never donated, please help us out, because in September we start our telethon to raise $40,000 to keep Bob Benyart Live on the internet for the next year. And what you can do, if you've never given before to Bob Benyart Live, if you subscribe to one of our services, or you donate or give or buy something this month, we will apply that to jumpstart our September telethon. So especially new givers, please, if you can call us, 800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. Help us stay on the internet yet another year. And in Arvada, Colorado, Maranatha Christian Center, what a great school. And our website, kgovkgov.com. May God bless you.